Luke chapter 17, we're going to back up and begin in verse 26. We kind of jumped into verses 26 down to 30, but we really didn't take our time there. Jesus answering a question about the coming of the kingdom. And no doubt is addressing, in large part, the perception that the religious Jews of his day had of the coming of the kingdom and of the coming of the Messiah and of the overturning of the Roman bondage that was on them. They were looking for a time when every man would sit beneath his vine and his fig tree. They were looking for emancipation, politically to be set free, and for Jerusalem to be the political center of the earth. They were looking for right things at a wrong time. And the problem was that they were blind to their own sin, that there was a political problem in their hearts too, that their wrong king was also there, that there was also a bondage in their hearts, just as in their minds. It wasn't just for Rome to be ruling over Israel, because they had the promises in the scripture of the prophets of old that Messiah would come and set them free. They didn't realize that there was also a bondage internally of sin and of death, and that also needed to be overturned. And that is why, of course, Christ had come the first time. They're asking about the kingdom that they understood, and Jesus answers them that it's not coming with observation. It's not coming as you think presently, but he says there is a time coming when it will come suddenly and by surprise. Verse 26, he says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the Son of Man. They did eat and they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day, again the important phrase, that Noah entered into the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, also as it was in the days of Lot, they did eat and they drank, they bought, they sold, the market was bullish. They planted, they builded new housing starts. Here it is again. But the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. Now, as you look at this study in the days of Noah, there are a lot of parallels. We could take a lot of time to look at the things that were happening in Noah's day that are being reproduced now in an interesting way, and some of those things on a scale that hasn't been in existence since the days of Noah. But the point that he's making as we come to this text is the suddenness of the flood, that though it took Noah 120 years to build the ark, and though God's message was preached to a generation that refused to listen for 100 years. Noah was a preacher of righteousness. The day when it finally came, it shocked the world. And what Jesus is saying, the lesson that's important for us, because throughout the New Testament, we're told to be sober and to be vigilant and to be watchful. And if you've been saved as long as I have, and, you know, since the early 70s, late 60s, we read, you know, Satan is alive and well on planet Earth, and Hal Lindsey's book, The Late Great Planet Earth. And we read all of the books about the coming of Christ. And we remember in the 70s and the excitement there was over the return of the Lord. Only the Lord didn't come in the 70s. And then we pushed back the date. We thought, well, he must be coming in the 80s. And if you add 40 years to this and you do this, you certainly must be here. And now here we are in the 90s. And I think the problem is that we can cool in our expectation of the return of Christ. And what Jesus is saying is that the believers in our age, you and I, need to learn a lesson from the mistake of the unbelievers in the day of Noah, because though they heard the message continually, it had no effect on them. They were taken by surprise. It shocked them. And Jesus is saying to you and I to take that and translate it into our own lives, that we can be accustomed to hearing over and over and over about the second coming of Christ. And what he's saying to us is we can't just sit around and say, well, it's got to get worse than this. Well, we can say that as Americans, but in a large part of this world, it is worse than this. And in a large part of the world tonight, believers, their only hope is lifting their head to the sky and looking for the coming of Christ because their children are dying in front of them and they don't know where they're going to get a meal today. And Jesus says when he comes, there will be part of society that is marrying and given in marriage and life will be going on as usual in certain places. As it was then, and it shocked them the day that the flood came. And he warns us to be aware, to be sober, to be vigilant. Again, as it was in the days of Lot. It says they were eating, they were drinking, they were buying and selling. They were building new homes. And that was the condition of society there until the day that Lot was brought out of Sodom and it rained fire from heaven and they perished. And there was a suddenness to it. He says, even thus it shall be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. So I think a lot of those things are very similar to the situations that we live in today. It is interesting that Ezekiel tells us this in chapter 16. Behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom. Pride, fullness of bread and abundance of idleness was in her, and in her daughters neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and the needy. And they were haughty and committed abomination before me. Therefore, I took them away as I saw good. It says, pride, a full belly, and idle time was what produced perversion in Sodom. The perversion started there when someone can produce more than what they need for their own family. When, you know, we see in our agriculture here in America today, the thousands of acres producing food. You and I can drive through somewhere and get a meal. We're not worried about, are we going to be able to eat today? A dog in America eats better than 2/3 of the rest of the world. And because we're not worried about where our next meal is going to come from, and because we're singing, I'm proud to be an American, there's idleness, there's pride, there's a full belly, what people look for then is sensation. And you know what? I can be prone to that too. You know, if I go somewhere to an amusement park with my kids, I don't like merry-go-rounds and Ferris wheels. I like the rides that make your heart skip, you know. I mean, if I'm going to go there and pay to get in there, I want to get on those things that turn you upside down and go fast and somebody else is throwing up while we're in the ride. You know, I want to, you know, there's something in me. If I'm going to go there and pay, I want to get something out of it. I like to hear people screaming. You know, amusement is a large industry in America. Muse is the word that means to think. When you put the prefix in front of it, A, it means not to think. It's a big industry in America today. Getting you not to think. Whether it's movies or whether it's drugs, whether it's pleasure, whether it's Atlantic City, whether it's Las Vegas, whatever it is. To consume our time so our brain is not working the way it should be working. And if a full belly and idle time and pride was what initiated the perversion of Sodom, then America is easily explained as we look at, because that is the way our society lives. And there's a challenge here not to be, you know, inculcated in that kind of an existence, that as the church we need to remember the poor. It says here they had no, we need to remember every day those people have it worse than us. When we start griping and complaining, we need to go to Shriners Hospital and help for a day with kids that don't have any arms and legs. When we start moaning and complaining, we need to go to one of the missions trip to Nepal or to Mexico to a third world situation and wake up and come back to reality. Because this isn't reality. This isn't reality. It can change like that. And the challenge is, if we find ourselves in a situation where God's bounty is still on this nation in an incredible way, that we shouldn't grow dull. That is the challenge here. That God is bringing. Lot's soul, it says his righteous soul, was vexed in the middle of Sodom. And I hope that as you look around you, even in the nation that we live in, I hope that, you know, I think the television sometimes desensitizes us. I remember during the Persian Gulf crisis, we watched that every night. It so drained me, I had to take vitamin B sometimes. But, you know, it becomes like a football game. After, yeah, get him, look at that bomb, you see the X, and now, bob, boom, you know, it's all, and you almost forget. No, these are human beings. These are people with grandchildren and moms and dads and cousins. And I think the television can desensitize us sometimes to reality. And we're told to be sober, to be vigilant, to be awake, because he says, even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. Now, take note of something here. It's interesting. He gives us a double picture. Noah is preserved through the judgment, and Lot is taken out before the judgment. And I think it's interesting that both of those things are set before us, because that's the way it will be when Christ comes, when the day of Christ begins, which I think goes from the rapture of the church to the end of the millennium. I think it's 1,007 years long. But when it begins, there will be those who will be preserved through, like Noah, the nation of Israel, 144,000, those many will be saved during that period of time. And I think there will be those like Enoch, like Lot, that are taken out before the judgment begins. And again, very interesting to hear the angel say to Lot and his family, I can do nothing until you're taken out of here. That's why Jesus says to us, and again in Matthew chapter 5, in the grammar, it's emphatic when he says, you are the light of the world. You alone are the light of the world. You alone are the salt of the earth. You're a preservative. The reason that judgment hasn't fallen on the whole world from God already is because you're here. And Abraham said, shall not the God of all the earth do just? Certainly he won't judge the righteous along with the wicked. Peter says he knows how to separate the wicked and the just. And the reason it hasn't fallen completely yet is because the church is still here. But there will be those that will be preserved through. There will be those who will be taken out before judgment comes. In that day, he which shall be upon the housetop, and his stuff in the house, let him not come down to take it away. He that is in the field, likewise, let him not come back. And we find these warnings in Matthew 24. Remember Lot's wife. Whosoever shall seek to save his life shall lose it. Whosoever shall lose his life shall preserve it. Remember Lot's wife. Interesting. The grammar is be in the habit of remembering Lot's wife, or be continually remembering Lot's wife. And you know something? How many here continually remember Lot's wife? Now, you probably do in more of a sense than you think. Now remember, Jesus is speaking to the apostles. He's speaking to disciples. Now, this is not a women's study, remember Lot's wife. This is for all of us. And certainly he's not talking, we don't know her name. We remember her. We don't know what country she came from. Did Lot drag her from Ur of the Chaldees when he came with Abraham? Or did he pick her up in Egypt and marry her there? We don't know. Did she seem to have a heart after those things? It says that as he chose Sodom, it was like Egypt as one goes down to Zoar. Or maybe she was a Sodomite woman. We don't know. Maybe she was a Canaanite that he met in the land. We don't know that about her. She doesn't seem very domestic. As you look at the story, it says God and two angels came to Abraham. And it says Abraham went and killed a calf. And it says Sarah kneaded the bread and prepared the meal. It says, when the angels came to Sodom, Lot prepared the meal. So I think the thing she liked to make best was reservations, I think. But we don't know much about her. We don't know what she looked like, at least not early on, anyway. There is today by the Dead Sea, and I've been there many times, a mountain of salt. They call Mount Sodom Jabal Uzdom, 5 miles wide, 7 miles long, and they say that's Lot's wife, but we know that she wasn't 5 miles wide and 7 miles long. That would explain why she would be lagging behind, but that's not her. It is interesting that Josephus, who wrote in the current with Jesus in his day, said that he had seen Lot's wife. Clement of Rome says in his day, shortly in the first century AD, that she was still visible. Irenaeus says not only was she visible, that you could still see her arms and her legs through the salt. Isn't that interesting? That would be an interesting archaeological find, don't you think? Wouldn't be a politically correct find, but it'd be an interesting archaeological find. Obviously, what we're to remember about her is that she was turned to a pillar of salt. I mean, everybody, your little kid in Sunday school, that's what we know about Lot's wife. And it says that she, you know, we have this idea that she turned around like Methuselah. You ever see that Methuselah with the snakes in her hair, bad hair day lady? And you turn and look at her and boom, right away you turn to stone. This isn't like Lot's wife looked back one time and boom, turned to Saul. It isn't, maybe she was, you know, crabby and Lot said, honey, look at that. You know, blue light special. It says she looked back from behind him. She lagged further and further and further behind as they were leaving Sodom. And from a distance behind Lot and his two daughters, from there, she was turning and yearning. And she was overcome with the judgment that came on the world that she knew. Obviously, the lesson is, remember Lot's wife. Be in the process of remembering what happened. She was overtaken in judgment. You know, it's to be an exhortation to us. And I think the interesting thing is, as we look at her, look, she actually had angels that came and warned her. You know, what do we need? She actually had angels that came. And they actually took them by the hand and drug them out so they wouldn't be, you know, judged along with Sodom and Gomorrah. But she was also a mom. She just had curtains, probably just got a new dishwasher. You know, her whole life was there. I mean, she looked back at her house. There were housing starts. The thing is, in her mind, she knew what was right. She knew judgment was coming. She knew they were warned by God to flee and not to look back. And she started out that morning when she left with what she knew, but she lagged behind in what she longed for. And the Bible tells us that we should guard the heart with all diligence, because it's from the heart that the issues of life flow. It's not from the mind. It's from the heart. There's something deeper within us than our mental capacity. There is desire. It's something we can hardly understand. It's more than, again, your physical capacities. You've eaten at a restaurant to where you're sinned and you're so full. You feel like you're going to throw up and you're trying to loosen your belt under the table or nobody sees you. And you can't eat anymore and the food's backed up your throat to the top of your esophagus. And then they bring the dessert tray. And you're going, I'm going to have one. Oh, I'll split that with you, honey. You know, it just, you know, has nothing to do with physical appetite at that point. Your body wants to die. You know, it isn't a physical thing. It's just you see it and you long for it. It's something that physically you probably don't have much capacity to fit more in. But the heart will always make a convert of the mind. And you can know it's right. And she knew what was right. And we can sit here tonight and say, oh, I read, you know, Volvoord's latest book, or Dwight Pentecost's latest book, or I've read the latest books written, you know, by Hal Lindsey or Grant Jeffries, or, and I know Christ is coming. We see the signs on TV, and you can still go out during the week and commit sexual sin. Still go out during the week and get stoned and sit there and thinking, oh man, I hope he doesn't come now. And it's because the heart makes a convert of the mind. If you let a desire play there and mill over and you ruminate on it and you don't turn to Christ and bring it captive to Him and you let it find a place to lodge there, as time goes on, it makes a convert of the mind. When people come in here that have sinned and their families are being destroyed, it is unbelievable to listen to the ridiculous excuses that they give of how they got into that circumstance. Their mind will think of all kinds of things to explain why they're there, but it's because it flowed from something deeper. It flowed from the heart. And she longed. It was deeper than her mental capacity. She knew judgment was coming. She was warned. She fled. She longed for Sodom. And the thing is, that, you know, the warning is, the reason it says remember, Jesus telling the disciples and telling us, we're disciples, to remember is because, you know, we can get in that place where we know what's right. We know, hey, the days of Noah, the days of Lot, in our minds we can agree with mental capacity. We can see the signs on television and Time magazine and we see the world is changing. But we can deceive ourselves in that and still allow our hearts to long after those things. What we do with that when it happens, you know, is I think, and 1 John is so important that we confess. We go to God and we confess when we're wrestling with something. Homologeo, to say the same thing. That's what confession is. You agree with God about what's wrong in your heart or in your life. To say the same thing as God. You confess your sin. It says, then He's faithful and just to forgive us and to cleanse, catharizo. Some of you have been in the hospital, you've been catharized. You know it's not a pleasant experience. What it does is it drains the poison out of your system that you're unable to get out by yourself. That if we confess, we go to God and agree with Him, this is wrong, Lord. That He's faithful and just to forgive us and to catharize us, to cleanse, to take the poison of sin out of our system and out of our heart. We stay in His word. Wherewithal shall a young man cleanse his way? By taking heed unto thy word, O Lord. I've hid thy word in my heart, not in my head, my heart, that I might not sin against thee. We're warned. Remember Lot's wife. That's his word. Where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be also. Then he says, whoso shall seek to save his life shall lose it. Whosoever shall lose his life shall preserve it. I heard the very famous celebrity who died within the last month, and I don't have the newspaper article yet, so that I'll protect the names of the innocent in the sense that I don't have the proof innocent. But I heard on his deathbed, the last thing he said was, I'm losing it. If I can get the article, then I'll... You seek to save your life, you'll get ulcers, grow old fast, lose your hair, get wrinkles, because you're losing it. People say that, I'm losing it. Well, let go of it. If you let go of your life, you can't lose. You got nothing to worry about because you got nothing to lose. Seek to save it, you'll lose it. Whosoever shall lose his life shall preserve it, in the sense of for the cause of Christ. Now, interesting. I'll tell you that in that night, notice nighttime, there shall be two men in your... I've got a King James here. It's in italics. It's because it's not in the text. It should just be two in one bed. One shall be taken, the other shall be left. Two women, you can cross it out in italics, two shall be grinding together at the mill. One shall be taken, the other shall be left. Two, again, men is in italics, not in the text. Two shall be in the field. One shall be taken, the other shall be left. Now, what is he saying? You have to understand, some people say, well, what he's saying is, one will be taken away to judgment, and the other will be left. Some are saying, well, one will be taken away in the rapture, and the other will be left behind. Well, it doesn't make any difference. What it's saying is he knows how to draw a line. He knows how to divide. When in relationship to his coming, he knows how to separate the righteous from the just. If it's leaving the righteous, taking the just away to judgment, or if it's leaving the unjust for judgment and taking the right. Either way, his point is he knows how to separate. And it's very interesting because he says somewhere it will be night, somewhere it will be evening grinding at the mill, and somewhere it'll be daytime in the field. Jesus is telling us the world is round. This will be a global happening when it happens. Because somewhere in the world it'll be nighttime, somewhere in the world it'll be evening, somewhere in the world it'll be daytime. That's what he says in those three verses. It will be a global experience. It will shock the whole world when it happens. And we know that. Jesus Christ is going to interrupt human history. Listen to what I'm saying. The Bible says the Lord himself shall descend with the shout, with the voice of the archangel and the trumpet of God, and we which are alive as believers and remain shall be caught up together in the clouds to meet our relatives and friends that have gone on already to heaven in the air. So shall we ever be with the Lord. Paul says, so shall we, including himself, because he expected it in his day, be with the Lord. Comfort one another with these words. That's our comfort. It's the blessed hope of the church. See how crazy the world is? It's crazy, isn't it? And you tell them, you know, it says we should be able to give an answer to every man for the hope that we have. You tell people, well, I believe Jesus died for my sins. I believe I'm saved, not by my own righteousness, but by what he's done on the cross. And I believe he's coming again. What do you mean coming again? Well, he's coming again. To judge the world? Yeah, to judge the world, but he's going to take me out first. What do you mean take you out? Maybe it's your mom. She's already thought about taking you out a few times herself. I'm going to disappear in the twinkling of an eye. And they're in the yellow pages looking under psychiatrist. You know, they think we're crazy for believing that. The world is crazy. We're not crazy. The world is crazy. Look at the world that we're living in. What are people hoping for in this world? Nuclear disarmament? Is that realistic? Has there ever been a generation of human beings that haven't used the weapons that they've made? And again, it's bad enough we're worried, you know, as Americans. I think when people that believe in reincarnation have nuclear weapons, I don't feel very good. What do they got to lose? Islam. They believe if they die for the cause of Allah, they go straight to heaven. What do they got to lose? I mean, it is even a rational game. We can't even play chicken anymore. Because the guy on the other side thinks losing is winning. How do you play chicken with somebody like that? The world is crazy. And the hope that we have is sane. And Jesus says it's going to interrupt human history and the world will be shocked. It doesn't matter that you're a minority. Noah, in his day, eight people were right and the world was wrong. Lot, in his situation, him and his wife, who was wrong later on, and his two daughters were saved and the whole cities of the plain were destroyed. Don't feel bad because you're not the majority in this conviction. That has nothing to do with it. Because Jesus said, narrow is the way that leads to eternal life. Few there be that find it. Broad is the way that leads to destruction. Many there be that go thereon. In fact, Revelation again tells us, multitudes, nations, kindreds, and tongues will marvel after the beast who receive his mark, whose names are not written in the Lamb's Book of Life. There's nothing to withhold his coming. I pray for a revival in the church. I pray for an awakening. I pray that we'll see a huge ingathering before Christ comes. He doesn't owe that to anybody. He's not indebted to us. It seems in the Old Testament, before judgment came, there was always at least reform. There was always a Josiah. There was something, you know, and in our hearts as believers, I think we hope that that will happen. Does he owe it to us? No. Look, it says, they said unto him, verse 37, where, Lord? He said unto them, and don't we all love this verse? Wheresoever the body is, there will the eagles be gathered together. Man, there's a lot of interpretations of that, isn't there? But you're going to hear mine, because I have the microphone. You know, some say it's speaking of the rapture. I don't believe that. because it's really, it's vultures there. It's not eagles. And I love eagles, but I don't consider myself a vulture. Some say it's talking about the birds of prey at Armageddon to come to feast on captains and princes and kings. And I don't think that's what it's talking about either. They're, of course, thinking Jerusalem, where, Lord? And one of the other gospels says, when, Lord? I think what the Lord is saying is this. Just as when a corpse or a carcass rots to the point where it starts to draw the vultures and the birds of prey, so when this world becomes so rotten and so putrefied with sin, in the same way, judgment then will begin to gather and to loom on the horizon. Again, because God measures time morally, not by the clock or the calendar. And consider where we've come morally. I mean, it's unbelievable where we've come. That they're admitting to 16,000 new cases a day. That's really nothing as far as death in comparison to 1.5 million abortions on average per year in America. And that's not my drum. I'm not beating it constantly. Again, interesting, if you're under 23, half your generation never made it out of the womb. Never born. You're in a 50th percentile. Satan's not done trying to destroy you yet. Globally, they're saying now 40 million abortions a year. 40 million. Which means we're willing, as a race, human beings, to kill for our own ends, to destroy life. And will we accuse God of being unjust if he decides to do the same thing? You know that in the last 25 years in America, those abortions, close to 35 million, you figure that is probably about 21 times all of the casualties of all of the wars we have ever fought as a nation since the Revolutionary War, up to the Persian Gulf. 21 times. Imagine this. In America, 35 million abortions in the last 23 years. Figure Philadelphia proper maybe has 4 million people in it. So that's almost 9 cities the size of Philadelphia. Figure from South Philly, take yourself down there, Pat Stakes, you know where I'm at. Spectrum, Vet Hospital, down there. Come all the way up through South Philly, past Yonk, you know, just come on up to South Street and keep moving up. And you know what the city is, all the way up along the river. Going all the way out here to northeast Philadelphia, all the way over towards Chestnut Hill, over in that direction, down Roxborough, you know, across to City Line Avenue, all of West Philly and Overbrook, and all the way down that side of the city, and then everything up Adams Avenue, everything in Hunting Park, and everything in the middle, North Philly. And just imagine taking every human being in a city this size and wiping them out, and then doing it to 9 other cities this size. It's unimaginable. It's unimaginable. It's a Holocaust. And that is by our own doing. You know, they say there's 26 new viruses now that are emergent that we don't have any means to treat. You know, AIDS may kill somebody average 2 to 5 years. The Ebola virus, some of them, there's 3 different Ebola viruses now. They kill somebody in 10 hours, turn your internal organs to jelly. 10 hours. No way to treat it. Contain it. No way to treat it. What do we do? I think we're ripe for judgment. Jesus says this, and he spake a certain parable to them to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint. I think we have two options in light of all of these things. One is to pray, and the other one's to faint. You look at the world, you know, I've got kids that I love dearly. And I look at them, I think they don't have a future, really. Do I hope to see my grandkids? And if I have grandkids, what right will my kids have to their own kids by then? And I don't know if my kids have a future in this country. I know this, this country doesn't have a future without my kids. And I better pass Christianity on to them in full force. In light of all this, he says, men ought always to pray and not to faint. If you look at the world around you, you're going to do one or the other. There was in a city a judge which feared not God, neither regarded the man. This is not Philly. This is long before. There was in a certain city a judge. I don't know if you've ever heard of a judge like this. Feared not God, neither regarded man. So he was powerful and heartless. Interesting, because those two things are the two tables of the law. He didn't fear God. That's the first of the commandments, the first table. Didn't regard his fellow man. That's the second table of the law. This man was heartless, powerful. Like the world, we see. We feel helpless. The system, the world, it's heartless. It's powerful. Washington, Russia, Tehran. What are we going to do? We're just individuals. Pray so you don't faint. There was a widow in a city, and she came unto him saying, avenge me of mine adversary. She doesn't say revenge me, just avenge me. Help me out of this situation. Help me, deliver me from this difficulty. She's not asking for revenge that someone would die. She's just saying, help me out, deliver me from this, avenge me of mine adversary. And it's said, by the way, that Roman judges could be bought for a pound of meat. Probably do that today, depending on the meat. And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, though I fear not God nor regard man, yet because this widow is hassling me. You see there in the King James, troubleth, that TH on the end means she is troubling me and troubling me and troubling me, and she has developed into a constant trouble for me. Yet because this widow troubleth me, she came in the courtroom, he said no. He came out to his car at the end of the day, the courtroom, she was standing by his car, he said no. Looking in his rearview mirror on the way home, she was following him in the car, going, please, please. He said no, and he tried to sped away from her. Pulled over to have a drink, walked in his favorite bar, she was sitting on a stool next to him saying, you gotta listen to me. Came home and she was parked outside the house calling him on her cell phone. Get up to go to work the next day. She was following him again. He said, though I fear not God, I don't regard man. Yet because this widow troubleth, is constantly hassling me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she wearies me. This lady is wearing me out. I don't know if you ever met a lady like that before. She is wearing me out. It's interesting, the Greek says, she give me black eyes. Where it says wearying me, I don't know if it's from a lack of sleep or just a bad reputation. Now, the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge saith. Shall not God avenge his own? Now, Jesus is not comparing his father to an unjust judge. This is not a parallel, this is a comparison. What he's saying is, if this guy, who is heartless, has no regard for God, you know, that which means he has no mercy, he has no fear of God, there's no sense of accountability, and because of that, then what flows out of that, he has no regard for his fellow man. And yet, if this guy, who's heartless, for the most selfish motives in the entire world, finally says, I'm going to take care of this lady because she's driving me out of my mind. He said, you hear what that guy said? And he's selfish. Jesus says, shall not God avenge his own elect, his own dear children, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them. I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find, King James says, faith on the earth, shall he find the, definite article there, faith upon the earth. You know, Jesus says this is what's going to happen. It's going to be like the days of Noah. It's going to be like the days of Lot. They're going to be difficult times. And people that seek to save their life are going to find themselves losing it. Take heed to yourselves. Remember Lot's wife. Remember how she longed for this world. And what happened to her. Because it's going to come as a shock when it does come. And God will know how to separate all over the earth. And it will come when this world becomes so corrupt morally that it's like a body on the side of the road that's rotting and the vultures are gathering over it. And if it's that rotten, it's going to be pretty depressing. Well, what do we do to face that? Pray. Pray. Remember that even in life, a woman can drive an unjust judge out of his mind to where he finally says, all right, all right, oh, you're crazy, okay. He says, shall not God avenge his elect who cry to him night and day? Yeah, we may face difficult times. You know, I don't know what's going to happen in America. I don't know. Is it just going to continue to go on like this? Is some terrorist at some point going to get a nuke in somewhere? Or a virus into a reservoir? Anthrax. Poor man's atomic bomb. They tested it on an island off Scotland in World War II over 40 years ago, and that island is still uninhabitable. You hear of VX and sarin and these other nerve gases that a terrorist might use. The thing is, the wind blows them away, and then you're done with them. You put anthrax down, and 40 years later, you still have a major problem. What will happen to the world that we live in? Will we just come every week, week after week, on Sundays, sing praises? Jerry Paradise? Imagine a guy with a name like that. Jerry Paradise will lead us in worship. We'll have a great time worshiping the Lord. And then we'll have Bible studies. And we'll sing songs about Jesus. And we'll hug each other and go home. And we'll never be affected by what's going on in the world. No, I'm afraid that it will touch our lives at some point. I don't think God will judge us with a Christ-rejecting world. The Bible is clear that he saved us from the wrath to come. But this world is due judgment that is separate from his wrath. It is just disintegrating in its own judgment. And what the Lord says to us is we should pray. We should stay in his presence. We should seek his face. We should pour our hearts out in front of him. We should be current in our communion with him. We should be talking to him. We should say, Lord, this world's freaking me out, Lord. And we should certainly be praying, come quickly, Lord Jesus. And he says, know this, that your Father does hear you. You're his elect. You're his children. His motive is love. Unlike an unjust judge, who selfishly would do something just so he ain't hassled. And when he begins to avenge, it says it will happen speedily. Entaxia. We have the same thing in Revelation. We have the same thing in the end of Romans chapter 16, verse 20. God shall avenge his elect speedily. He's going to crush Satan under your heel speedily. It doesn't mean fast, because here's the church 2,000 years later saying that wasn't very fast. Doesn't mean it's going to happen. It is not a Greek word that means soonness. What it means is once it starts, it will come to a swift conclusion. You ever see the cartoon where the guy falls in the snow and he starts rolling, turns into a snowball, and just his feet and his hands are sticking out of it, and it's getting bigger and bigger, and it just snowballs. That's what we have, a tachometer in the car to measure speed. Entaxia means once it begins to happen, it will snowball to its conclusion. It will happen speedily. And here we are crying out, you know, come Lord Jesus. We, like the psalmist, we look at the world. And the psalmist in Psalm 73 says, when I observe the wicked and I looked at their prosperity, my feet well near slipped. I almost stumbled. Because I looked at people that were just no good and they were making money hand over fist. They had the best cars and the prettiest women and the handsomest guys and the most power, and the world was unjust, and they could pay off judges, and they could do whatever they wanted to do. And here I am, little Christian, trying to be nice to everybody, trying to stop to help somebody with a car broken down, and he steals my wallet. I try to pay my taxes, and I can never keep up, and this jerk down the street is selling heroin, and he wins the lottery, too. And I want to get some of this. This is not fair. The psalmist says, when I observed the prosperity of the wicked, my feet almost slipped, almost went down, almost took me. And he says, and then I went into the house of God. And he says, I brought my life back in the light of eternity. I brought my perspective back in the light of eternity. That's one thing that should happen here as we gather. We should bring it back into the perspective of eternity. Because there's a day coming when we will all stand around his throne. And it says, he himself will wipe the tears from our eyes. You will feel the hand of Jesus upon your face. He'll wipe the tears from our eyes. There'll be no death, no sorrow, no suffering, no sickness, no curse. There will be a reunion with grandmothers and parents and children and standing around his throne with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So remember Lot's wife. Don't let your heart draw you to this present world. Don't think that worldly men have something that you don't. Listen to the voice of a multi-millionaire in his last gasp saying, I'm losing it. And realize you can't hold on to any of it. But it's your Father's goodwill to give you the kingdom. That's what the Bible says.